Mentored by some of the best minds in entrepreneurship in the world, then you're listening to the right podcast, Ditch Digger CEO. We're going to be interviewing CEOs and founders who will be telling their amazing rags-to-riches stories. These entrepreneurs who dominate the industries they serve will be sharing the secrets to their success. We'll be talking to millionaires and billionaires, many who started with nothing. You're going to be mentored with golden nuggets of shared experiences from my guests, whose time is worth thousands and even tens of thousands of dollars per hour. I started in the paving business right out of high school, and with no college education, mentorship has been my education of choice. I started over 25 companies in the last 20 years, have generated over $1.5 billion in revenues. My guarantee is this: if you listen to Ditch Digger CEO and you want to be more successful, you will become more successful. The secrets of my success and for many of the world's greatest business leaders will be revealed. Let Ditch Digger CEO mentor you.
Here we are today with another awesome Ditch Digger CEO guest. We can't wait to get started. We're with Srini Ka, who's a co-founder of a couple companies that we're going to learn about, and one that's he's scaling in an amazing way today. And we just want to have the conversation, as always, to talk about Srini's amazing American dream story, right? And so welcome, Srini, to Ditch Digger CEO.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary. Pleasure and an honor to be here. Thank you for having me. Again, just the discussion we just had, again, super inspiring about your story as well.
Yeah, you know, so Srini, you know, we have a blast on the show because we basically just listen to people talk about, you know, how they discovered their niche, how they became successful in the industry they're in. We prefer to really find people and their friends and people we run across that are top, you know, 1% of their industry, and people that have kind of bootstrapped it, right? Kind of started with not a lot. And you know, we call that, you know, the Ditch Digger CEO American dream. And I, you know, I've been blessed to be part of that. So all we want to do is kind of hear your story, ask you some crazy questions here and there, and then let you tell your story. So that's our goal today. Is that okay?
Fantastic. Sounds great.
Awesome. So Srini, where are you at? Where do you hang out? What's your where do you live? Where's your offices and all that?
I live in the Bay Area, South Bay, south of San Francisco. Offices in New York and Bay Area and Los Angeles here in the U.S.
Srini, okay. So where do you live? Where's your business house? And what do you call home?
I live in the Bay Area in California, South Bay, south of San Francisco, offices globally, here in the U.S., in New York, San Francisco, and L.A. But, you know, teams spread across, I don't know, probably 15 cities here.
What determines where you're going to go with your other offices?
Yeah, I mean, we go where the customers are and where the talent is. I mean, it's very, those are primarily the two criteria that we use. I mean, if you get some good talent, I mean, given the post-pandemic new normal, you're trying to find talent wherever they are and go to where they are rather than having them come to where we are. We are focused on the media side of the business, media entertainment. As we know, LA, New York are the two primary centers where... Cool. The M&D industry functions. So,
sure. Now, let's before we get into business, let's talk about kind of your upbringing, family background, right? How you came into this entrepreneurial mindset. What was your family life like? You know, growing up, where did you grow up, and what did that look like?
I grew up in India, as probably most as you might have guessed from my accent already. If not. So grew up, my father was a low-level government employee. Mother was a homemaker. So pretty much grew up in a low to middle income household, again, hadn't even thought of entrepreneurship. I didn't even know that, you know, one could start their own company growing up. So it was a fairly...
What city were you in? I've been in India. I was there for 45 days in Bangalore. In Bangalore.
Oh, wow.
So where were you at?
I was a little south of Bangalore. I grew up in Chennai, which is a couple of hundred miles from Bangalore.
Sure.
South of Bangalore. That's okay. Then did again, as you know, you should guess from a lot of Indian parents, middle class Indian parents, a lot of pressure to do engineering or become a doctor. So end up wanted to actually be a poet growing up, forced by my parents to some extent to actually pursue a career in engineering. But then I started doing computer science software, loved it. I mean, really fell in love with computers. This was back in the 90s. Fell in love with computers, did my undergraduate in computer science. Out of that, came to work at Texas Instruments in Bangalore. Texas Instruments was the first international company, tech company to start their office in Bangalore, in India, for that matter. The first IT company, if you will, that actually started. So back in 1985, so was considered the, you know, the go-to place, if you will, at that point of time. So it was really good. Spent the first couple of years, you know, building software for designing chipsets. And 2.5 years, one of my friends and classmates from college came up and said, "Hey, I want to start something. Would you like to join?" And again, as I said, I had no idea what it meant to start a company or otherwise. I was living with my brother, had no expenses. I said, "Hey, I was just being a nice guy." And I said, "Yeah, sure." I mean, I couldn't say no, right? So I said, yes. I mean, didn't even know what that meant. Then, you know, a few of us together came together and actually looked at, okay, let's go build something. And we had no idea what to build. I mean, no idea at all, right? Young kids, sufficiently young and naive, we thought at that point of time. I mean, this was just the start of the IT service revolution in India. Lots and lots of IT services companies were cropping up. So we said, hey, let's go build a product. Let's not do services. We want to build a HP at that point of time. That was aspirational, or Microsoft or Sony, a global brand. And let's go build it. And again, no clue about what building a product meant. Tried a whole bunch of things. I mean, we'll you know, put together a PowerPoint presentation about a product. We'll go pitch to somebody and say, "Hey, would it be interesting? Would you be interested in buying it?" Tried a whole bunch of stuff. Eventually, ended up building what was then one of the first versions of Bluetooth back in 1998-99 when Bluetooth had started. One of the first three or four companies globally building software for Bluetooth. Again, just as an experiment, again, we didn't know, and Bluetooth was free. We could just download the specs and start building. So it was easy. We said, hey, just going to learn. The intent was not to go build a company around it, but just to learn how to build a product. But again, given that we were one of the first few, we didn't realize it at that point of time. Customers came calling and say, hey, if you're looking for something to, you know, put on our phones, put on our desktops, put on our, you know, mice and, you know, stereo devices and so on. Eventually,
back in that time, was it who were the big players? Was it like BlackBerry, or who was the big players? Motorola,
Nokia, Sony Ericsson, Motorola. Of course, Samsung was there. Those were the major ones. We ended up licensing through both chipset vendors and directly to companies like Motorola, to Sony Ericsson, to Samsung, to Broadcom, to TI, and a whole bunch of people who would actually incorporate this tech into their phones, into their devices, into their chipsets, and pay us a royalty for every unit that they ship.
At this point, Apple was not in the game, right?
Apple wasn't in the game yet. They were not in the phone business at that. They had an iPod. Wow. So we built one. There were a bunch of these device vendors that were building headphones for iPods. So with a Bluetooth connector. So we licensed to them. So we had a product that was working for iPods, there was no iPhone at that point of time. So.
Wow.
So scale to be the leader in Bluetooth, specifically focusing on audio globally. But somewhere, I mean, this was like, we started in 1999, somewhere about 2003, 2004, we started seeing that pretty much every chipset vendor, like as I was saying, right, Broadcom, Texas Instruments, all of these chipset vendors would license from either from us or from a company like us and would actually give it away for free. They would pay us a royalty, but they would just, you know, give it away for free in the market. So it was getting commoditized fairly quickly. So I said, hey, let's go build something on top, a larger product. Started looking at building Bluetooth headphones and stuff. But again, at that point, I started talking to some of these companies like, you know, Dolby's and the Logitechs of the world to go build that. But, you know, some of these companies came back and said, hey, we'll go, instead of you guys buying, let's buy you guys and build that together.
So wait, let's go back a little bit. Tell us, you know, what was the solution? You know, what are the major problems that Bluetooth solved in the industry?
Bluetooth was, at that point, it was very simple, right? There was a need for wireless communication, right? So we had, you know, phones and people were trying to, you know, transfer files between phones. That seems so easy now, right? They were trying to transfer files from a phone to a laptop. They wanted to, you know, listen to music using a wireless headset. They wanted wireless mouse and wireless, you know, keyboard. All of them had their own proprietary 2.4 gigahertz. They were not interoperable with each other. You had a device, you had to buy from Logitech and you had to buy an adapter on the laptop. Otherwise, it would not work with your laptop. So it was, you know, tons of these peripheral devices, if you will. Bluetooth was the solution to create a wireless user experience. And it was an industry-wide standard brought together by Nokia, Microsoft, Intel, and a bunch of players saying, hey, let's make an industry standard so that every device, doesn't matter who's building those devices, whether it's phones, devices, you know, cars, any of that, they can talk to each other using one single unified interface. So we built the software that powers it, the whole software that actually that sits in a phone, sits in a car, sits in an iPod, if you will, and can talk to the other device. That's the what we'd call as a protocol software is what we're building.
Wow. And then how much competition do you have of, you know, others trying to build the same thing?
So in, there were a handful of companies, probably three or four companies that were actually trying to do, probably a couple that were successful. Most of them actually either, over time, I think went out of business or got bought out eventually. But the Nokias of the world were also trying to build their own internally. Some of these larger companies trying to do their own, companies like us that actually were building software for these companies, and then the chipset manufacturers.
And was this your company, ImpulseSoft?
Correct. What? The name of the company was ImpulseSoft. I mean, started on Impulse.
That's wild. It started on Impulse. I like that. Okay. And then you know, where did that go from there? So 2003, 2004, you got headsets now, and all this stuff is coming out more and more. You guys are partnering with some of these big, tech companies, these big mobile suppliers. What did that look like?
It started to see a lot of commoditization in the business. So we said, hey, let's go raise some money, go build an end product, not just software. Maybe we'll build an headphone, or we'll build a Bluetooth printer. We'll do something that's actually much larger. So we started looking to raise capital. At that point in time, we had some seed round that we had done earlier, really hadn't raised any money, was pretty much bootstrapped from that perspective. As we started looking out to and started talking to some of these strategic larger companies for investment, they came back and said, hey, why don't we actually, you know, buy you out and actually go build this together? So got a bunch of offers, eventually got acquired by a company called Surf, SIRF. They were the largest GPS chipset manufacturer, NASDAQ listed, largest GPS chipset company. You know, those days when, you know, used to have GPS, not on phones, but you had to have it on devices and such. So they were adding Bluetooth into that. So that Surf is now, again, that's now part of Qualcomm. So at that point in time, they were an independently listed company. So they came in, made an offer, and said, hey, okay, maybe we should go sell this and go build something else.
Cool. And what year was that?
This was in late 2005, end 2005.
Okay. So then what do you guys stay on for a while with that company?
We stayed on for a couple of years as part of the transition. So technically, we actually promised that we'll be there for at least 2 years. So December 2007, we ended up, the 2 year period ended, we actually quit.
You and your original partner?
And there are two, so essentially three of us, the three of the founders from the previous company, we quit and actually started Amagi.
All right, now tell us about that. Tell us about that vision, kind of the idea, you know, what you guys saw that others didn't see.
So when now we were in our 30s, the good news is that we had money in the bank. Right. So two good things. Hopefully we were old. Certainly we are older. We are hoping that we are wiser from the experience from the previous 6 years. And we had money in the bank. So we could actually, you know, think on a much larger scale. So the intent was, hey, we started something. Our original goal when we started ImpulseSoft was, hey, go build a Microsoft, Sony, HP, and a really large global brand. It was successful. We had a great successful exit. It was a fantastic journey. We all enjoyed it, but it was nowhere. I mean, it was not even a drop in the ocean from where we wanted to start. Now, can we reset everything and say, hey, what can we do? What can we do that is actually, that will make an impact in the world? So that was the intent. I said, hey, let's do blue sky thinking. Let's look at, you know, can we do something that will, if it doesn't change the world, forget changing the world for a second, can change the industry that we're going to operate in so that there is a pre-Amagi and a post-Amagi era, the industry will look different because of us. We would have actually made an impact. So let's look at some, you know, what can we do that can be transformative for whatever industry that we're going to be in. And then that was goal number one. We said, hey, goal number two should be, it should truly scale. It should scale. You know, globally, it should scale to, you know, from a revenue, multiple billions of dollars, from an impact, you know, truly be able to impact thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands of people. And three, we should have fun, right? It should still be, you know, interesting. It might do all of this, but if you're not, you know, it doesn't something that we like that it won't be. So you looked at a whole bunch of possible, interesting opportunities, innovations on the tech space, right? This was, again, pre-Android. Android was just coming out. iPhone was just going to come out in 2008. So we were 2009. So we thought, hey, maybe there is a smartphone, because there was no smartphone really at that point of time, a social smartphone. We looked at a whole bunch of different things. And eventually, one of the things that kind of stuck us was television was changing in a really big way. YouTube had come in. Right, people are watching YouTube a little bit on desktop and mobile, but really television was still, you know, traditional cable satellite TV. We thought, you know, eventually that's going to move towards much more of an internet-based TV, a connected, you know, smart internet-driven TV. That's a big transformation. So we're thinking about saying, hey, what would be the second order effect for this to happen? What infrastructure do you need? What would it mean? You know, if that happens. So we thought eventually television will become much more personalized. The big screen you'll end up watching. I mean, we still were thinking traditional channels today, but the channel can be different, right? I'm watching ESPN. If I like golf, I'll see golf. And you like tennis, you'll see tennis. Somebody else likes football, they see football. It doesn't need to be the same stuff at the same time, right? Yeah. So we said, hey, both content and advertising can be personalized. And that will happen. The world was moving towards an internet-based economy and television was lagging, right? So we thought that's the next frontier, if you will. Let's go build for that. And seemed like a large opportunity, seemed like, you know, a transformative effect that we can have on the industry. And media, entertainment sounded like a lot of fun. So checked all our boxes. So we actually looked at it and actually filed our first patent, US patent in 2008. About personalizing content and advertising for television. So that's how the journey started.
I love it. Hey, you guys, you know, had a vision that many people didn't have, and you know, you're thinking past what was in front of you at that time, and it's come to fruition in a big way. So can you tell me about you know, what that looked like? How did you get started now, and tell us how you came up with this name?
That's a good question. So when we started the company, we first had to, you know, go incorporate the company. This was started in India, in Bangalore. So the previous company was also based out of Bangalore, ImpulseSoft. So we had to incorporate the company first. We didn't know what area we're going to be in. We didn't know what we're going to be doing. We didn't even know which markets we're going to be selling. Where are we going to be? Right. So we wanted a culture neutral, technology neutral name. And we wanted something that had that is not just a bunch of vowels or consonants put together, but something that had meaning that we would like. So looked a whole bunch of things. And of course, you know, we wanted a domain that was available that we didn't have to pay a fortune to get.
Sure. So
as we're doing research, we came up across this name called Amagi. Amagi means liberty and freedom. It actually was the first ever word used by humans to denote the concept of liberty and freedom. Back during Mesopotamian civilization, Sumerian days. So apparently, I mean, this is my understanding, right? Ma means mother, gi is go. Amagi is those days, you know, people used to send their children as child labor if they were indebted to someone. So once the child pays off the debt by working, and then they say, you're free now to go back to your mother. That's what Amagi means. Go to your mother.
Ah, I love it. I love it. You know, liberty and freedom are a big thing to me, and that's an awesome name. You know, and what is this business gonna do? Right, as you grow it, you're gonna create that liberty and freedom for many. That's what you're doing.
And for that was the hope. Absolutely, absolutely. And it seemed like, hey, two syllable, easy to pronounce. We thought wrongly, easy to pronounce, and now we see, hey, people say Amagi, Amagi, Magi, whatever, right? But we thought it was easy to pronounce. Two syllables. Had a great meaning, depth, and we could find a amagi.com domain name for $5,000. So
yeah,
that clinched the deal.
I love it. Okay, so tell me how you went after your customers. How did you, you know, who did you envision would be your first customers? And you know, how did they work out? Did you have some relationships already you were able to call on, or what?
Zero relationship in the media industry. We're complete outsiders. We were tech guys. Didn't know anyone. So again, cold calling, random cold calling, calling friends, family, finding out some way to get to a couple of guys in the media industry. What something interesting happened, right? The first few months, we thought, hey, let's go build this. We thought, you know, TV, you know, we'll go to the ISPs, the telcos, the pay TV operators that will actually bring the internet to television. So we talked to a couple of them, found got to the right guy. And the first feedback that we received was, guys, in India, about 5,000 people in 2008 are watching television through internet. You guys want to build a business for that? You got to wait another 5 years before anything will happen. So we came back, pivoted, right? Changed the whole all business plan and said, hey, let's not try to do, you know, internet-based television. Maybe that's further down. Let's do for satellite TV. Can we actually do targeted advertising? Using satellite, it was a digital connection. Can we actually deliver targeted advertising to start with, and then targeted content? It went back, talked to a couple of satellite operators, and they said, hey, it has less than 5% share. I mean, you guys can't build a scalable business if that's what you're targeting. Guys, look at cable. Cable is where the business is. Again, remember, this was analog cable days. This was pre-digital cable, right? So when came back, again, changed the business plan, rewrote the entire business plan, and said, hey, forget about targeted advertising. I mean, targeted advertising on set-top boxes. Let's do geo-targeted advertising, where you could have local advertising in every market because it's all analog cable. You couldn't target at the individual level. Let's do, you know, local advertising on television. And that was in India, did not exist as a market, as an industry. There was, you don't see dealer ads. You don't see any local ads at all. The TV was always national in India.
Yes.
So there was no local. So all of any local advertiser, if it's a small and medium advertiser, they had to go advertise on print.
Yeah, I think that's pretty common even in the U.S. back then.
There was at least a couple of options from Comcast and others, right, where you could have some 1 minute of real advertising.
True.
There was some local advertising that was available. Absolutely did not exist whatsoever. So we said, hey, that seems to be a market, large multi-billion dollar market, massive opportunity in terms of small advertisers wanting to be on TV, but can never pay for national TV. It just didn't make sense. So can we go build a business around it? So that's where we ended up starting off. What we didn't realize when we started was, if we had to create a completely new industry segment that did not exist, the amount of effort that you need, the amount of change that you need in the industry is massive.
And yes.
We were super tiny guys sitting in Bangalore, which is not even a media city, you know, trying to penetrate into an industry we had no clue about, we didn't know anyone about, was was daunting. Again, as you would say, I always think of entrepreneurship as a mix of both arrogance and humility, right? Mm-hmm. Arrogant that you believe in the vision, doesn't matter whatever everybody else says, you think it will happen. Humility that humble enough to listen, to figure out how to get there.
And you mentioned this a couple times, like smart enough and strong enough to pivot and realize, boy, you know, my idea isn't quite perfect as I thought it was. There's a couple of changes we probably have to make. And you do, and you pivot like you've done, explained already a couple of times.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think willing to change, willingness to listen and change, right? Anytime. I think that's a big critical trait. So we went and talked to advertisers, local advertisers, and said, hey, if we had this, if we gave you an option to advertise on national television, maybe at a fraction of the cost, maybe 1/20th of the cost, would you be interested? They all jumped at it. They said, hey, where should I write? Whom should I write the check to? So that's not easy. I mean, suddenly we got like everybody jumping at it. What we didn't realize. So then we went to the national networks, television networks, and said, hey, give us some inventory that you have. Let's go do local ads in different markets. You know, instead of selling it to one advertiser nationally, we'll split it into 20 markets. We'll sell to 20 different guys. You'll make more money than what you did initially.
Sure.
Absolute resistance. I mean, the sales guys in the TV network, they didn't want to. That was giving up control. They felt, hey, if I'm going to, you know, sell my inventory at a fraction of the cost, even if it's for only one city, one state, and that's devaluing my inventory. I don't want that. I don't want the third-party tech company sitting in between and deciding what ad should be played, right? So there was so much resistance to that. So we spent almost a year trying to convince at least one network to sign up.
Wow. Wow. Just one.
So eventually, we ended up signing up with a couple of news networks.
How were you able to get in front of them? As outsiders, how were you able to get in front of them?
A lot of cold calling. Reaching out to someone. I mean, I would send LinkedIn requests to people that were in the industry. They wouldn't respond directly. So I would send to somebody who would then say, yeah, sure, I can have a chat with you. And then I'd ask them, can you make an introduction to this guy? And so on and so forth. So yeah, it was just plain vanilla, good old cold calling.
That's awesome.
So we ended up starting off with, you know, a couple of cities with a couple of networks, went very well. Again, saw some tremendous advertiser interest, expanded 2 cities, 4 cities, 8 cities, 20, 35 cities.
Okay, wait. Now you're in Bangalore still. Are you still in Bangalore?
I was still in Bangalore. We were still in Bangalore.
And these cities were all India.
We're all in India, right? The television networks, local market. So started expanding to other cities. Then we started adding more networks. Eventually grew to be the second largest buyer of advertising inventory in India.
Whoa.
Some of the largest networks, the top three networks. So grew to be the largest ad network.
When you got to that point, Siri, was that like 2010, 12? What was that?
No, this was a long journey. I mean, this was 2013, 14. Actually closer to 15. So by the time
So 7-8 years before you got to this point, right?
Yeah. But we were growing. I mean, we were thrice recognized by Deloitte as the fastest growing, or first or second fastest growing media entertainment company in Asia. So growing at a really, once we got off the start, first network, the first city, second city, third city, once we got to a scale, then it was, yeah, absolutely. There was tremendous momentum.
So Srini, well, how many employees did you have, let's say, about, you know, 2014, 15, when you got to the stage?
Probably about 150 or so. We had like 65 odd salespeople in each one of these cities going and selling to the local advisors and some of the larger advisors.
Yeah.
We had a tech team, and there was a back-end operations team. So, and we had raised money. In the meantime, we had actually, the gentleman actually, okay, on the fundraising, right? In parallel, I mentioned that we had raised some seed funding in the previous company. So we went to the gentleman that actually wrote that check when we started the second company. He was a billionaire, was a founder of one of the large IT services company, Infosys in India. Phenomenal, great gentleman. So we went to him and said, hey, we're looking to start this company. He just wrote us a check for, I think, $2 or $3 million without even knowing what the business plan was. right?
Yeah, you have so much confidence. You already proved yourself to him, right? I mean, that's awesome.
So
the relationship of trust.
So we took that, and obviously we had our own money as well. So, you know, ended up, you know, using that initially, and then ended up raising a whole bunch of capital as well. I'll come to the broader capital raising subsequently. So we'd grown, it was growing massively. Then we had three headwinds, right? One, the television networks, as we started growing, we are starting to call on their advertisers and offering them all of these local options. They were feeling threatened. The ad sales team was saying, hey, you cannot go to a Procter & Gamble. You cannot go and sell to a Colgate, or you cannot go sell to a Nestle, right? So they started feeling that, you know, their sales was getting, you know, affected, possibly, at least, right? Saying, hey, you're calling on my advertisers and actually offering them a lower cost option to pick whatever regions they're interested in rather than buying national, right? Two, there were four networks in India that would control about 85% of all viewership and all inventory, right? And they realized that, you know, without inventory, we were nothing, right, as a company. So they started raising prices. As I said, right, with some of these guys, we were the second largest buyer, and we would pay the highest rate, probably 30% higher than the smallest advertiser, right, to buy the same inventory, to actually be able to take that and split.
But you're right. You were able to pay a little more because you're buying fragmented, right? And you're able to pay a little more. But now they
absolutely. So let's say we buy for $100, we would split it across 18 different markets, and each market will sell from anywhere between $5 to $50 per market, depending on the size of the market, right? So, you know, even if you had four markets that we could sell at any point of time, you would actually make the money back. So it was good. Sure. But you know, we are seeing pressure on increasing prices. And then somewhere in 2016, Indian government at some point of time decided overnight to make cash illegal, all the currency illegal, overnight, right? They said, hey, all the banknotes are illegal. You'll have to get fresh banknotes. You'll have to return all your banknotes, and I have to get something fresh. That was a massive disruption. As you can imagine, people stopped buying because they didn't have cash. There were long lines in front of the banks to go get their cash exchanged. So pretty much, right? So at the back end now with these networks, we had bought massive inventory. We had contracts, annual contracts committing to millions of dollars, of tens of millions of dollars of inventory. At the front end, advertisers just stopped buying because they were not selling. So we had this massive disruption. No way to go. So we pivoted again. In 2016-17. At this point of time, we had already started taking our tech. We built this whole tech on the cloud, you know, enabling and started offering as a tech as well to broadcasters outside India, television networks outside India as a technology.
When did you enter the cloud?
No, the day we actually built our first software in 2008, that was all on cloud. So we had pretty much start everything because we didn't have hardware infrastructure. We didn't have, you know, servers and such. Everything
was built on cloud. You're way ahead of everybody back then. I didn't know what the cloud was back then.
Exactly. No, I didn't think it was even called the cloud then. We thought it was called AWS hosted environments. AWS had this option. So we said, hey, Amazon had this option. So we just started building for that because it was cheap.
Awesome. Yeah, yeah.
So we had this tech that we actually had built for all of this. And we had started licensing to customers who said, hey, I want to use the same model elsewhere outside India. Maybe for doing local content insertion, maybe for creating my channels and so on and so forth. So we started seeing that, you know, there was potential for the tech itself while we were facing a lot of headwinds on the advertising side. So we pivoted in 2017. We decided to shut down the entire advertising business that we had built. Had to let go of everyone, the entire sales team, phenomenal sales team that we had, unfortunately. Had to let go of everyone from a sales perspective. And pretty much start from zero, close to zero.
Wow, that's crazy. So that's 2017 you're in Bangalore still.
2017, I moved to US.
Did you know that Silicon Valley was the place you had to go?
No, I actually moved to LA, Los Angeles.
LA first.
Where we thought the media industry would be, is. So started talking to potential customers about this, you know, this tech that we had on the cloud that can help them create channels, TV channels, run it on the cloud. Again, initial set of customers, they pretty much were laughed out of the room. Saying, hey, cloud, that won't work. Mine is too precious. My content is way too precious to put it on the cloud, some third-party server. I don't. And again, we were completely an unknown entity as well, right, as a company. So we had no credibility, zero credibility, new market, no customers.
So it wasn't like you could use like the testimonials and the relationships from that you had in India, and they don't like transfer to US.
Very, very, very.
Man. Okay, so when you think about this, your revenues totally stopped, right? Totally. And what were your revenues back then, 2016? What were your revenues?
We were probably 2016. I think I'll have to go back and check. Probably we're about $20-25 million in revenue.
At that point. Totally, 100% just stopped in its tracks.
Correct.
And then how long? Okay, before, I mean, so then you had to, you know, live off of whatever your nest egg was to be able to, you know, recalibrate and move to LA, right? And how many people moved with you? Just you and your couple of partners, or who?
Oh, just me.
Just you. What about your partners? Where'd they go?
They were in Bangalore because again, between the three of us, one of my partners focused a lot more on product and tech, which was still happening in out of India. Our partner was running all the operations and support. That was again still happening out of India, and I was looking at the business side of things. I moved to the US. By the time we had a couple of reference customers on the tech side in the UK, we had actually sold to a really tiny startup called a tiny company called Horse and Country. So they had a TV channel about horses, as you can imagine, and country living, right? So they were looking for really cost effective options using cloud, and we had actually sold them. Heather was the CEO of that company and founder of that company. I remember when we first met her. I mean, we were nobody, right? Out of India, didn't have anybody at all. She liked us. She liked what we said, but she wasn't quite sure we were really trustworthy. We were a fly-by-night operator. We had something. She actually flew to India, wanted to see our offices, see whether they're real people, is it a real company? Actually, she liked what she saw and actually signed up. So that was the real big breakthrough. First media customer, tech customer, international, that actually signed up with us.
Awesome.
So we had a couple of these customers, and we had a couple of Indian customers on the tech side who were actually using us for international. So we had a couple of, in that sense, tech references, but not really anybody local here. So the first, initially it was difficult.
Let's go back to personal. Did you have a wife and family yet at this point?
Yes, I was married. I'm still married, had two kids.
What do they think about this? Just up and moving across the pond.
it was a surprise for them. I mean, it was a new adventure. They were open. They were a little worried. But we're open. I mean, we're interested to see where this takes us.
Wow, that's awesome. Okay, so then you move across the pond. You started an office in LA.
I was working out of home. There's one person, so really not an office in LA. But obviously, we built, we incorporated here. So started going out and talking to customers. An interesting thing happened at that point of time, somewhere in the 2017-2018 timeframe, was there is this entire streaming that finally started taking off, and what was called as free ad-supported streaming, where you could actually watch TV, traditional TV channels, completely ad-supported. There was this company called Pluto. There was if you remember, Samsung and Roku had started these apps where you can come in like Samsung TV Plus. You can turn on the app and you can start watching a bunch of channels. So that had started, and a lot of guys that had content were looking to find some software to deliver to these channels. And we had this perfect technology software that we actually had. And these were small content owners. These were YouTube guys. These were, comparatively small. So they didn't care about cloud or whatever. They wanted some really good software that would actually just work out of the box. Mm-hmm. So I think we are super fortunate. So just about the time we made the pivot, this big thing was happening, which was our original personalized television on internet was happening. And we had the software that actually could support it. So suddenly we had these handful of customers that were really digital companies that were not traditional television companies, digital companies that were looking to get into television. So they liked the software. And we had our first customers sign up in 2018, pretty much.
2019?
18. Okay. So from then on, I mean, I think from 0% of the business, today, US in the last 5.5-6 years is close to about 75% of our business now globally. We publicly announced that last year that we crossed $100 million in ARR. So it's been a phenomenal journey from absolutely nothing over the last 6 years.
Crazy from 2017, right, to today, you went from nothing to about 900 employees now, 900 teammates?
Correct.
That's unreal. How do you onboard and really guide these people and you got to share your vision, your processes. What your team's got to be incredible. Your operation team's got to be incredible. And to be able to tell these people your story from the buy-in to your vision. How do you do all that?
Especially with this tiny thing called COVID as well coming in.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't even mention that, right?
So yeah, no, it's a challenge. I mean, I think it continues to be a challenge as to how do we actually communicate as we expand, really scale, really really fast and globally. We are now in 12 countries, people across 12 different countries, from Australia to Korea to India to Germany, France, Europe, Middle East, and LATAM, and in Mexico and US and Canada. That's it.
That's all you've done in the last 6 years.
It's all. No, one thing I realize now, Gary, is that, I mean, as we scale, it's less about a lot of time I spend and my partners, my co-founders spend is actually in communication, is being able to provide the context, is be able to communicate the vision, is to be able to communicate why we are doing it, why becomes much, much more important. When you're small, the what is much more important, what and how. When you're really small, how is much more important. So you're working with the team saying, hey, how do we get this done? Let's do this. As you scale a little bit more than what, and say, hey, how do we ensure that we are providing clarity of the what that they have to do? But then as you scale the next level, you want to be able to provide the context and for them to decide the what, and you provide 100%. The why.
Yep. Okay, scalable. You've discovered their market's very scalable. When you think of these, the other two things, right? Impact, what impact today are you making, and what do you see tomorrow? And then fun. Are you having fun? Okay, so those two things I got to ask you. Are you having fun? And then what's the impact you've made so far? And what type of impact, in your opinion, are you looking to make in the next 10 years, let's say?
Excellent question, Gary. So absolutely having a lot of fun. I moved from LA to New York to Bangalore, New York to back to San Francisco. So since seeing being in different places, so I love change. I love moving. So having fun there, having fun working with tons and tons of customers. We now have more than 800 media brands globally that actually use us. Take the largest television networks here, largest broadcasters here. We pretty much work with every one of them, say maybe about 80% of the largest brands here and in Europe as well. On the free ad-supported streaming TV, we are the largest player globally. We pretty much grew the industry from a free ad-supported streaming TV as seen as the central player in the market. So I think from an impact, I mean, fortunately, we've been able to make an outsized impact compared to the size that we are in terms of the industry, especially on the free streaming side. More than 50% of all free streaming channels are powered by Amagi.
Wait, how many? More than what?
50% of all free streaming channels are powered by Amagi globally. And the free ad-supported streaming is the fastest growing segment within the media industry. So again, globally, this is where the action is. And we have been, fortunate to be able to drive the growth of this industry. We power, I think last year we powered more than, we streamed more than a few billion hours, I think probably close to 10 billion hours of, we do a billion ads a month from an advertising perspective.
So it seems like you and the team have a really good perspective on what's coming on the horizon. How do you and the team like maintain that perspective? And what's coming on the horizon, and how are you preparing for it?
Well, that's always a challenge, Chris, to be able to look at saying, hey, what's changing in the industry? What can we drive from a change as well in the industry? One thing, if you look at media in general, media is going through such a large transformation. It's one of those industries where there's such a phenomenal shift from how we as consumers are consuming. Right. I mean, look at just what has happened over the last 5 years. All our television habits have dramatically shifted. Right. Instead of watching traditional cable TV, a lot of us are, you know, watching streaming content today. As of last month, I think officially streaming television surpassed cable, traditional linear, more than 50% now market share in terms of viewing. So there's a massive transformation that is happening. And we have seen a transformation from pure subscription towards ad-supported, towards free happening as well, even within the streaming side that is actually changing. Mm-hmm. And two, at the back end, there are tons and tons of these media companies that are doing, that are transforming their infrastructure from, you know, large data centers, lots and lots of people operating these channels to much more cloud, much more software-centric, much more autonomous, much more automated. So it's about being able to look at saying, hey, what do these changes mean? Where do they take us? What's the second order effects? What are the third order effects? Okay, if streaming happens, if all of our content consumption happens on television using streaming, and if TikToks of the world are moving towards connected television, what would that mean? What sort of infrastructure would you need as a technology to be able to, you know, enable, whether it's advertisers that are trying to reach these audiences? What sort of infrastructure do you need for content owners? There are now, 2 million professional content creators on YouTube that make more than $100,000 a year, right? So what do they mean? How do they actually get them onto, you know, beyond YouTube to a traditional television? Right. So you look at second, third order effects and say, hey, I mean, it's hypothesis. You say, here are broad trends that you actually look at saying, hey, what can we build to enable some of that infrastructure? The good thing about tech is you are a picks and shovels player. You're not taking bets on who's going to win. You're just taking bets on what the trends are and trying to build for those trends. So that's the good news.
That's awesome. Okay. So when we think of the cloud, okay, we're our business, our technology company, as I told you, we're creating a lot of data. We started out, we were boots on the ground, we were managing the pavements, you know, pavement maintenance budgets for about 50 million square feet of pavement customers, okay? That was 6 years ago. This year we'll have over 6 billion We think 6 billion square feet of pavement management for our customers, Walmart being one of the big ones, and 20 other companies are some of the biggest real estate holders in the world. And so I don't know enough about this, right? But is there a threat to data? I mean, I understand that, you know, the data storage it takes is tremendous as we do these and we continue to grow. What happens in the future? Are we with all the AI things that are going on and all this all this extra data capture? Is it more data centers? Is it more efficiency in new data centers? What has to happen to make sure that we have the storage for all this amazing information of the future?
Oh, excellent question, Gary. Again, my opinion is this: right, with AI as AI matures, this requirement for storage of lots of data will actually come down almost counterintuitively. AI should be able to, you know, the reason why you're storing tons and tons of data is you're always trying to get insights, newer and newer insights from that. AI should be able to summarize, should be able to identify the critical data point that you really need to store, and not to have to store all your raw data on everything. So it can actually make it more efficient, I feel. right? Rather than necessarily, I mean, because we don't know how to use the data, we end up storing tons and tons and tons of data from a raw data perspective, because we feel someday, somehow we'll make all of these connections work. And that would change.
Okay. Because I think about that. I'm just wondering, is there a threat there at all? Or, and I'm sure, you know, people are figuring out how to make this work. And you're, like you're saying, with AI, be more intelligent data capture, right? And unnecessary data won't be stored, right? Or duplicative, right?
Unnecessary, or even store insights rather than just data, right? Beyond a point, you know, you'll just be able to, you know, take off all the previous data and say, hey, let's keep the key insights and actually use that for building for future rather than necessarily storing everything forever.
Awesome. Okay. Okay, so Srini, one more thing. I want to talk. The technology company we have that we're building could be in any country, any developing country in the world, because we're creating efficiencies for our customers, not just in pavement pavement management, but also roofs and facades. And we'll be getting into every single facility's maintenance budget, right? And we're doing it 50 times faster, okay? It used to take as much as a month to go do all the do all this work on a million square foot building for Walmart. Now it takes hours. Okay, used to cost tens of thousands of dollars. Now it costs hundreds or maybe a thousand or two per property. And now it's in the now we do have there is a SaaS product today. 90% of our customers are now SaaS driven instead of job by job, right? So this business is really growing in value and all that, but we're just now, for the first time, building a sales force behind it, because I was blessed with a lot of the customers I needed already in the paving industry that I could put this in front of and pilot it with, okay? We have done like zero sales, and the business value is about $150 million and growing. So I want to talk to you more about questions like expansion. How do I expand market by market, find partners in Bangalore and anywhere in the world that has anybody that has big knowledge or big relationships in the real estate industry would be a great leader of a market for me, right? That can grow a sales force, and so that's my thing in the future is to really build this business like it deserves to be built to make the impact we can make. I want to get in markets across the world and finding the right person to do that in every market is going to be key. It's culturally they have to match with our culture, but really the biggest thing for us and them is what type of relationships do they have in all different real estate markets or facilities markets? Because if they already have those relationships, it's going to be really easy to sell, because it's the most efficient way to manage real estate in a way with world class engineering that has ever been seen. So you're growing. You would have the courage and the guts to grow globally like you're doing. It's really cool. I don't have any, I have a lot of friends in technology, but not too many that have done what you've done. Where you said, "Oh, okay, we're going here. Now we're going to go there." And you like traveling. You like new things, so you discover new markets, and nothing stops you. So it's not very common.
Thank you. So are you do you already have partnerships outside today, Gary? That will actually you typically partner with infrastructure companies or real estate companies. These would be brokers. These would be builders. What's the typical?
So for us, it's existing properties that people want to maintain at whatever level, right? They want to understand their budget, create the most longevity out of whatever they spend. Okay, so we give them the engineering tools, the specification tools, and the expectation tools that they need, and as well as when you look at a property, if you're in a Class A environment, you want to keep that building a Class A building. What does that mean, right? What does that mean? Well, it means that your roof should be in this condition. On a 0 to 100 scale, it should be a 70. Your pavement should be at a 75. Your facade should be similar, right? And here's what that looks like. And then here's what the budget looks like. And here are the specifications that you need to call out to your contractors, right? And here's the warranty that you should be demanding from your contractor. And by the way, we have a warranty tool that highlights the warranties. And if you have a product that's got a problem, it red flags it to you and the contractor to get their butts back to fix it before the warranty expires, right? So it's a really cool product. And it's just, it's about all we've learned a lot in 40 years, right, of how we can serve our customers better and educate them better. And with that, this tool has been built, right? So it's really fun. But my goal now is to build a sales force and to grow in markets across the globe, because right now we have about probably 3 or 4 customers that have us doing delivering this product in Europe and in Japan, Europe, South America, but we don't have any offices. We have nobody selling in these markets, and so we're crazy not to do that, right?
No, absolutely. Massive global opportunity. And I presume you don't have too many competitors as well from a vertical SaaS perspective.
No, very little. So it's fun. So again, and are you in YPO? Or what leadership groups are you in or have you discovered any that help you as you lead? You know, leadership is a lonely place sometimes, right? I'm in YPO and a couple others. Have you joined any?
No, I talked to YPO, but you know, again, given that I was moving between cities regularly, I just couldn't end up joining any of those.
And how old are you now?
I'm 49.
You just missed, but there's other ones. I mean, YPO is a 45 limit, but there's a lot of other ones, as you probably know. But for me, it's been a lot of fun to be involved in some of these global leadership organizations that, you know, find people that have some experience and things that I haven't. But I'm sure you've with your network, you don't lack that anyway.
No, I should. I mean, I've been actively thinking about just given the moment. So I do want to be able to go join both to learn from others and to be able to contribute.
Fun stuff. Okay, let's go. There's a couple of things. You know what? Where do you see your industry and your team? What does it look like in 10 years?
Well, I think there's a unique opportunity in the media industry. There is no player that actually provides unified one single platform that the media industry could use to operate their business. We are hoping to become the industry cloud, the media platform, the media cloud for media entertainment companies to run their entire business. Today, they use probably, you know, dozens and dozens of different tools for different parts of their business, you know, whether it's content acquisition, you know, how do I produce content? What sort of logistics do I need for producing a piece of content? To how do I do post-production, whatever else that I have to do from editing to post-production that I have to do, to how do I distribute this content? How do I store this content? How do I add metadata to this content? How do I monetize this content? How do I get data and analytics out of this? Each of these are, you know, dozens and dozens. There are probably tens of thousands of vendors today in the industry, and there's no one unified solution. We are hoping to become that backbone, the infrastructure that the media companies will use for their entire end-to-end business, to run their business. That's where we are going towards, Gary.
Awesome. Okay, when you think about your growth now in the future, has America given you the ability to do this when most countries you couldn't have done it in? That, you know, I like talking about the American dream, right? And that's something I've been blessed to be a part of, being born here and being able to figure out that it's the best place to discover the American dream. Tell me your opinion on all that, being, you know, seeing all different countries, being, you know, born and raised in India. Tell me what your thoughts are there.
Well, I think the few things that actually, you know, that happened to us when we actually, when we started in the US, when I moved to the US, one, it opened the world for us, not just US, it actually opened the world for us. I think if I were to look at, you know, doing business elsewhere versus US, I think the single biggest difference that I see is people trust you, right? So people are willing to try and trust. I mean, a lot of other places, you start off with distrust and you have to earn the trust. Here we actually can say that, hey, I can go and tell that because there's such a strong legal justice system that people have recourse to. People can actually, you know, if you know, people are comfortable that you're not fraudulent to start with, right? You're not establishing credibility. They take you at face value. If you had a good product, you can actually go and sell that. You don't need, I mean, that's a massive difference that I see. The friction of doing business in the US is so much less compared to India or any other market that we have been. Right. So that's and to the scale, just the scale that we actually see here is phenomenal. Again, everything is 10x of, you know, what you'd see elsewhere. Just the size and scale of what you could actually get to. Three, I mean, talent people. I mean, the experience, the people that you have that you can actually get here in terms of people that have been there, done that pretty much in every area. right? So allows you to scale much, much, much faster overall as a company. So I think we would be nowhere if we hadn't started here.
Awesome. Awesome. You had the guts to do it. And your name, Liberty and Freedom, and it's the best name I've ever heard. You know, it's Amagi, I didn't know that was what it meant. I should know that because I really believe in liberty and freedom. But, you know, you're going to find that here. Not that we don't have to fight for it, right? We can't get lazy and think that it just happens. Because if we as entrepreneurs and blessed people that we are don't fight for that a little bit, you know, it won't be here forever, as we see, you know, Venezuela and other countries and what's happened in these countries that were free before, right? You better fight for it, like Ronald Reagan talked about, and many, many great leaders of our country have. So
this is one value that is worth fighting for.
It's worth fighting for. I'm going to fight for it until the end. That's for sure. Because I want to make sure that, you know, our grandchildren and next generations have the same opportunities we had. And Chris, what do you got for this amazing guy? Chris usually comes in and he throws some little learning lessons that he got out of this. And he'll talk about that a little bit, and then we'll close things out. But this has been awesome.
Yeah, Sri, this has been incredible, man. I'm supremely enjoying this. So you said earlier that you and your team don't try to figure out exactly, you know, what, I guess, industry to get in next. You follow the industry as a whole, I guess. You follow trends. Can you talk about the trends that you and Amagi are currently seeing that you're preparing for next?
Yeah, if we had to look at media in general, then that's what we are focusing on, media industry as a whole. Obviously, all of us know AI is making a disruptive change across every industry, and that's happening even more so in media. From everything we all seen the writer's strike. A lot of it has been about the disruption that AI could potentially cause there. So clearly seeing a massive disruption from all the way from how content gets produced, what content gets recommended to us, and how do we get to watch the right content as consumers that we actually do. And how do we actually, you know, use AI to localize? I mean, one thing that Netflix, for example, Netflix as an example, has taught us is that content travels well internationally. Being able to, obviously, Hollywood content has always traveled globally, but you're also starting to see, you know, Korean content doing extremely well, you know, whether it's Squid Games, whether it's, you know, interesting Spanish content that's coming in. Or so how can we now localize? How do we actually make this content, leverage AI to localize the content for every country, for every language that's out there? The cost of localization has been prohibitive traditionally in the media industry. I mean, now it's going to be a small, extremely small fraction of what it's going to be. How do we actually prevent, how do we create the right kind of fake media, deepfake AI in content? I mean, can actors live forever, right? Can I actually start licensing my personality, my character, even beyond my own lifetime, right? So I think phenomenal. And I'll, of course, ensure that we stop fake news and we stop, illegal fake media as well on the other side. But I think there's tremendous opportunity in terms of where AI can take us on one side. And two, in terms of, you know, the type of content or who can create content, again, we've seen a massive trend in terms of now TikTok, the time spent on TikTok now exceeds, at least for the younger audience, more than even what they spend on TV, right? So what does this mean, being able to enable creators at all levels in all places to come and actually be able to deliver content in a meaningful way? And how would that change? That's a massive. I mean, the whole creator economy is a huge trend as well that we're actually obviously looking at. Three, advertising, right? I mean, the way the advertising has been done in television has been the same for the last 60, 70 years. Nothing has changed. you're watching something, there is a break, and then some an ad pops up, and then you get back onto content. I mean, that does not make sense. How do we actually make advertising much more immersive, much more integrated, much more social? So I think advertising will go through a dramatic transformation on how companies reach out to their audiences.
Any specific thoughts on how the traditional advertising model with media will change?
So we are experimenting with a whole bunch of things, how advertising can be integrated into the content itself. I think that's going to become, again, with AI, now we can have tremendous opportunities on how there could be natural advertising experiences within the content.
And you could do that with legacy media too, like the French briefings could be drinking a bottle of Snapple.
Exactly, right? So you can make it much, much more natural, especially with the AI, and the cost is now realistic for our advertisers to look at. I think as we look at different ways of consumption from a consumer perspective, I think we'll give more choices to consumers on what sort of advertising that they want to watch or whether they want to watch advertising. And we're already seeing that between subscription advertising, but I think there are a lot more opportunities available there in terms of the way in which we want to consume advertising. I can decide to watch TV without advertising, but willing to take more ads on my mobile, whatever, right? Combination thereof, that you can actually have a much more consumer-driven advertising options. As an example, these are things that we're experimenting with.
Wow, that's really fun to think about and fascinating to consider all the possibilities here. You've expanded our mind today, Srini. Really, really appreciate that. So some of my favorite takeaways are all the amazing things you shared today. That's incredible that you and your team were some of the first folks to work on Bluetooth software. I love Bluetooth, so thank you for that. I use these guys every day, little AirPods. Start a company on impulse. I think that's some fun advice. Content and ads can be personalized. We're just digging into the insane amount of personalization you can have, even in legacy media. It sounds like, your story is not so different from kind of Netflix talking to Blockbuster in like the 2000s, where they got laughed out of the office. They wanted to sell themselves to Blockbuster for $1 million, and Blockbuster's like, beat it. Laughing now?
Because regret. Yeah.
It's Srini, we have those two stories on our podcast. So those friends of ours were the founders of Netflix and Redbox. They both had similar stories about going to the video store giants and selling their business to them, and it didn't work out for either one of them. But it really actually did work out. It didn't work out so well for Blockbuster, right?
Well, that's an amazing story when you think about it, right?
They're great guys. You have to hear one of my buddies, Biju, came also from India, went to school here and stayed here. And then he was one of the founders of Redbox. But if you get a chance to listen to those two, they're good ones.
I will do that. Absolutely, I will do that. Redbox is a customer of ours as well. We work very closely with them. So I would love to listen to the founding story.
Awesome.
Yeah. And then even if your country kind of halts all business by demanding that all cash be exchanged for new cash and COVID, as long as you're focused and conscious of what's on the horizon, you can reach more than 50% of all streaming channels to be powered by your company, which is an incredible feat. Srini, where can our audience find out more about you and Amagi?
Our website, www.amagi.com, amagi.com, has tons and tons of more information. People can also reach out to me on LinkedIn. Love to connect to people.
Srini, I love your story. You know what? You're a mild-mannered gentleman, but I can tell you're actually a tiger inside. You know what? To do what you've done and have the courage to do the things you've done has been really cool. So your story is going to continue to grow, and you're going to do those three things. Number one, you're going to have a lot of fun because life's too short not to have fun while you're doing these things, right? But you're going to scale to an amazing level, and with that scale, with that scaling, and you know, you and I think alike. I mean, people say, "When are you going to stop? You know, when are you going to stop? When is enough enough?" Right? Well, I sincerely believe we need to make the most impact in our lives in the short time we have here, and if we can scale great things to amazing heights, hopefully it can make a bigger impact. If we sincerely want to do good things for the world and our country, the world, our families, our friends, and industry, then why do we stop, right? This is the fun we have. And I believe that, you know, people like you and I and many of our guests will live, you know, just healthier, longer lives because the energy they create by you know, making an impact and having a lot of fun scaling, right? The energy you create for yourself and everybody around you, I think is extremely strong. So we can see that in you with your positive attitude, your mild manneredness. But boy, I can tell you are a competitive guy that's going to always be a great mentor, a great story. So we appreciate you being on. That's for sure.
Not at all. Thank you, Gary. I again, inspired by your story as well.
And like I said, I know it's just a podcast we've done, but you're a friend for life, buddy. Because I love who you are, and I want to get to know you better sometime. And I'd like to follow up with a phone call sometime.
Absolutely, I'll take you up on all of those offers, Gary. Thank you.
All right, awesome. Well, thank you so much for everything. I appreciate you being here today. Our listeners are going to really get a lot out of listening to you. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Gary. Thank you, Chris. Excellent summary there. Appreciate the time.
Until next time.
Have a wonderful day.
If you enjoy this show, please share with anyone else you think will find value here. And please go to our website, ditchdiggerceo.com, for show notes, links, video clips, and more nuggets of entrepreneurial wisdom. Don't forget to follow me on social media at ditchdiggerceo. Paper routes, mowing lawns, careless hands. Daddy had 6 kids to raise. Factory and not a neighbor, my name. Learn by example, not the words you said. Watched his every move and followed his footsteps. Come on. Pick and shovel in these two hands. To the soup, where a CEO I'll stay. Now, all the lessons I learned.